नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Okay, beginning our devo, and we're setting aside this day to practice. And the theme for today was suggested was very much in line with developing our practice. So it works very well in a container like we're setting up, where we take the precepts and we set aside some time and we ask people to leave us alone and we make some arrangements so we can have a simple meal and a comfortable place to sit where we won't be distracted and practicing. But then, what is practice and how is practice done? And how do we make practice not just a physical activity where we, oh, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, but where we're cultivating the mind? Yeah. Because this is the highest form of practice, as the Buddha describes, bhavana, development. And the highest form of development that the Buddha describes is to deal directly with the fundamentals of the mind. And to accept that we, because we are not a solid, stable, permanent entity, because we are made up of different parts that are always changing, that we can very consciously decide what parts we want to make up our mind. We can say, I'd like to get rid of this angry part, and I'd like to put in a kind part, and I'd like to get rid of this stingy part and add in a generous part. And through this process, this kind of these switching out these different blocks, we find that after this process, we are a different person than when we started out. This is something that many people in the world don't actually believe is possible, because they go on these diets and they read these self-help books and they do all these things. These they stare at a mirror and say, "I am successful. I am successful." They try all of these things to try to make themselves into a different person, and it doesn't work. Their bad habits are still there, just because they haven't dealt with this basic notion. They still think they exist, that they are a thing. And so they've reified that thing that they are. But in practice, we're going to sit down and to bhavana, to cultivate the mind. We are going to imagine those things that we want. And once we can picture them, once we can really see what it is, the quality we want, we're halfway there. Yeah. If it can arise in our mind, then it's possible. If we can recognize a quality in another person, we can also be that other person. We can change the components and have that quality. This is the power of the mind. We are not one thing, because we're always changing. We can always move in the direction that we want to move. So today we're going to look at three parts of our practice that we can, if we can't imagine what that is like, then we start out by trying to imagine what that is like. What is samadhi? What is equanimity? What is energy and effort? Yeah. We start by trying to figure out what these are. But once we have an idea, an essence of what these are, then we're already moving in that direction. We just have to gather strength and momentum behind these ideas, and then we wake up one day and we find that that's part of what we are. That we are samadhi, that we are equanimity, that we are energy. So we'll start off with the sutta that became the theme of the day that was suggested, and this is. I'll just read this off. It's not a very long or complicated sutta. And it is Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Threes, number 102. Though in some of the older listings, it might be 103, because they argued a bit about where the cutoff was for certain suttas, but this happens. But I think in the modern day, we call it 102. And this is the Nimitta Sutta. And we'll discuss what nimitta means, but I'll be using Ajahn Tanisaro's translation, and he translates the word nimitta as theme. And so this is the Nimitta Sutta. Without any preamble, the Buddha says, a monk or a practitioner, as it were, intent on the heightened mind should attend periodically to three themes. They should attend periodically to the theme of concentration. They should attend periodically to the theme of uplifted energy. They should attend periodically to the theme of equanimity. If a practitioner intent on the heightened mind were to attend solely to the theme of concentration, it is possible that their mind would tend to laziness. If they were to attend solely to the theme of uplifted energy, it is possible that their mind would tend to restlessness. If they were to attend solely to the theme of equanimity, it is possible that their mind would not become rightly concentrated in samadhi for the ending of the asavas, the outflows. But when he attends periodically to the theme of concentration, to the theme of uplifted energy, and to the theme of equanimity, their mind becomes pliant, malleable, luminous. It is not brittle. It is rightly centered and concentrated for the stopping of the outflows. Just as if a goldsmith or their apprentice were to set up a smelter. Having set up a smelter, they would light a fire. And having lit a fire, they would take hold of some gold with their tongs and place it in the receptacle. Periodically, they would blow on it. Periodically, they would sprinkle it with water. Periodically, they would watch closely. If they were to only blow on it, it's possible the gold would burn. If they were to only sprinkle water on it, the gold would become cold. If they were to solely watch patiently, then the gold would not come to perfection, being at the right temperature. But when they periodically blow on it, periodically sprinkle it with water, and periodically examine it patiently, the gold becomes pliant, malleable, and luminous. It is not brittle. And it is ready to be worked. Then, whatever sort of jewelry or ornament they have in mind, a belt, an earring, a necklace, a gold chain, that gold would serve their purpose. And should a practitioner periodically attend to the theme of samadhi, concentration, of uplifted energy, and to the theme of equanimity, then whichever of the higher knowledges they turn their mind to, they could know and realize them. They could witness them for themselves whenever there is an opening. Should one cultivate their mind in such a way, it is possible they could wield the manifold supernormal powers. And here the Buddha lists all the various stock phrases we have for mental psychic powers that a meditator could cultivate, culminating in the three higher knowledges, which is the knowledge of past existences, the knowledge of the divine eye, which sees other beings arising and passing away, and finally culminating in the greatest of all mental powers. If they want, then through the ending of the asavas, they will remain in the asava-free awareness release and discernment release, having known and made manifest for themselves right here and now. They can witness this for themselves whenever there is an opening. Okay, just a simple and straightforward sutta. And I don't have to tell you the simile is pretty, yeah, it's pretty sh that's the easiest part, right? We imagine a goldsmith and they have a crucible and they've put in some gold. Maybe they're melting down an old gold ornament, or maybe they've got raw gold ore. And it has to be made homogeneous and brought to the right temperature, so that it can be poured into whatever mold they have, or shaped by hand into a particular shape. Now, to get the gold to that perfect temperature and to get off all of the dross, all of the impurities, they've got to attend to it very closely, because this is back in the day before they had thermometers and careful, precise ways of measuring this. So they had to do it by sight, meaning part of the process was to be patient. And to trust that you're adding heat, it's getting hotter, to trust that the impurities will float to the surface when it reaches a certain temperature, but to also know that it's up to you to temper it. Yeah. It can't be just add heat, add heat, add heat, done. But you have to maintain this heat for the right amount of time to get it just right. And so sometimes you're cooling it off. And the simile extends to our practice. And the Buddha points to three different things. He says the theme or the nimitta of samadhi, which is the concentration or composure of the mind. Samadhi is a purely wholesome mind state. So the basis of samadhi is to attend to something wholesome and to focus our mind on it, whether it be something beautiful or even something repulsive, but to have a purely wholesome relationship to that thing. If it's something repulsive, then it brings out a sense of renunciation in us. But if it's something beautiful, it brings out appreciation, generosity, joy, respect. Whatever theme we're attending to, when we're attending to it towards samadhi, then we're trying to purify our mind of all the dross, all of the unwholesome thoughts. This is not the best state for developing wisdom. When we're developing equanimity, we want to see things in a balanced way, right? We want to have the pleasant and the unpleasant, the good and the bad side by side so that we can weigh them and see how equal they really are. So to develop equanimity, we want to be a bit back from this process of only looking at things in a positive light, only looking at things in a wholesome way, and just look at things as they are. It's a lot like the goldsmith just carefully watching, but not changing anything. Yeah, and this is how we develop equanimity. We just let things be as they are, for good or for ill. And we say that they are doing so based on causes and conditions. We remove ourselves as an agent from the process. And somewhere in between, we have this theme of uplifted energy. Yeah. And this is the mindset of it is possible for us to alter the circumstances. Yeah. It is possible for us to decide. It is possible for us when there is a place where we're slipping, it's possible for us to be active. And there's a place where we've really already accomplished something. It's possible for us to abide with aroused energy and to be satisfied and content and ready to move whenever necessary. Yeah. And this is like us putting the pot, the crucible on the fire. Yeah. When we have control over our energy and our ability to strive, it's like we have the fire is always ready. It's always going. And we can add sticks whenever we want. Yeah. We need more heat. We add some sticks. We have enough heat. Okay, we're good. I'll wait. I'll watch, but I'm ready at any moment. If we were to just constantly add sticks. Well, I don't know what happens to gold when it gets too hot, but I imagine it's going to make a mess. Yeah, I imagine it'll be splattering all over the place. And likewise with our mind, if we just keep adding sticks, we're going to be an anxious mess. Yeah, and this can happen in our practice. So the Buddha is saying he's saying something very simple and something very complicated. The very simple thing he's saying is we have to balance where we put our energy. We have to balance where we put our focus. It can't be just samadhi. It can't be just wisdom. It can't be just effort. But it has to be a mix of the three. And we have to ask ourselves at the outset of any endeavor, what is the appropriate one to cultivate here? The complicated thing that the Buddha is saying is that these are different things. Yeah. And sometimes in our practice, like when we're cultivating mindfulness of breathing in Anapanasati, you read through the different instructions and you see all three of these are active. You see, in the beginning, there's the effort we have to put in to combat the hindrances, to focus the mind, to get it to actually stay in the realm of mindfulness of breathing. And then we find there's the aspect of samadhi. As the mind starts to become bright and happy and pure, we start feeling piti and sukha, the joy that arises from concentration. At this point, we're inclined, we're supposed to let go. Yeah. When we start to feel that joy and that energy, we want to just keep doing what we're doing. Yeah, keep focusing on those wholesome things that are bringing our mind to samadhi. But in these very same instructions, once we attain the jhanas, once we attain the pinnacle of samadhi, we're supposed to pay attention. Then we're supposed to watch how things go of their own accord. And we're supposed to say, well, look, even jhana is temporary. My mind got so bright, got so pure, and then it got crappy again. And then all of these defilements kind of walked back in. And not immediately, but in time they came. And why is that? And we watch with equanimity and we begin to understand the Four Noble Truths. We begin to understand it's because of our desires that we get drawn towards all of our suffering, all of our problems. And that temporarily getting over our defilements is not permanently getting over our defilements, that final permanent state can only come through understanding and wisdom and true letting go, through seeing. Yeah. And any one of these, all three of these aspects are in, the progression of a good meditation subject, like Anapanasati or mindfulness of the body, or the Brahma Viharas, cultivating them to their maximum extent. Yeah. And yet we're not doing all three of them at the same time. The Buddha is saying each one of these is its own kind of dial that we can move up or down, and that we're only actually working on one at a time. If we're letting things go their own way, well, then we're not only focusing on the wholesome. And if we're arousing energy, we're not just letting things go their own way. And if we're focused on the wholesome, then we're not going to see our desires and our defilements as they arise and cease. We're trying not to have any, right? So these are three different things. And how do we make a practice of like working with these? The Buddha sets this up in a particular way where he's talking to meditators of the highest caliber. And when the Buddha does this, he uses a word that we see gets taken by the commentaries, and well, they have a field day with it. And the word is nimitta. Yeah. And nimitta is used a lot in the context of heightened meditation, of the higher mind. And what is nimitta? What does nimitta mean? And if you were to look up a translation of nimitta, you'd kind of plant your head in the rabbit hole. And you would see how far it goes. And there's no easy way to translate it, partly because there's no easy way to understand what a nimitta is. If you were to look it up, the first thing you would get is what's in the commentaries. And they use the word nimitta as a sort of an image or a sign. Yeah. And the sign is something that arises to. Almost as a sign that samadhi is arising. The most basic nimitta, as they describe it, is like an afterimage. If you were to stare at a light for a moment and then look away, you'd have that light as an afterimage would be burned into your vision. Likewise, if you were watching a horror movie and somebody jumped out from around a corner with a knife, you would look away in horror and fear. But that image of somebody with a knife would be burned as an after image in your mind for several seconds or several days. If you've ever seen something on a in a in a movie and then it just kept coming back to you over and over again, that's a nimitta, right? It's an after image, yeah. But this is the most coarse, basic form of a nimitta. It's just an after image that you have no control over. It's a sort of echo. But in the development of samadhi, eventually you get to the point where it's not an after image at all, but the mind is actually has coalesced around a theme. And we find that the person with the knife, that it had enough emotional impact to kind of burn itself into our mind like a light, precisely because there was something underneath it. There was an idea that tapped into fear or danger or threat, or enemy. A core idea or symbol or sign that is much more essential to the mind. And once we get past that surface level stuff and the mind becomes very calm, we start to see there are these symbols that have a lot of power, a lot of emotional context that are broad reaching. Sort of, it's not just one thing, but it's like a network of things. Yeah, what is an enemy? Most you think, well, with somebody who's trying to hurt me, or somebody who's trying to thwart me, or somebody who doesn't like me. It's somebody in another country or in another group, or this enemy is a very multifaceted thing. And yet you say, is that person your enemy? You could look at them and you could decide yes or no. It's a multifaceted thing, and at the same time, you know instantly what an enemy is because it has impact, it has weight. In the development of samadhi, this is animitta that we actually start to have some control over. It'll arise and it'll show us a particular symbol underlying our mind. And if we develop that even further, it becomes the basis for a whole meditation. Some famous ones are the sign of the beautiful or the sign of the repulsive. These are nimittas, the nimitta of beauty. What we find at the as we're getting close to the jhanas and we're cultivating these nimittas in this particular way, is that the symbol of beauty is not one thing, but it's two things. And we've already laid the groundwork for this last month, if you were here when we were talking about views. The two things that the symbol is made of is knowledge and vision, right? So the way the commentaries talk about animitta, they talk about the vision, which is an object. And this object could be anything. It could be a bright light. It could be a cloud. It could be a symbol. It could be a tactile sensation. It could be a heart feeling, like with the Brahma Viharas. Yeah. But it's one thing. It's like an object. It's almost, almost touch it. It's tangible, and yet it's moving. It's malleable. Yeah. But at the same time, there's a knowledge. Yeah. And this knowledge doesn't have a form. Or what is beauty? Well, we find ourselves looking at a beautiful sunset and we say, well, that is beautiful. And the person next to us says, yeah, you see them all the time. It's not that beautiful. And we realize that the beauty is not in the sunset. The sunset is a form. The sunset is a vision. And that beauty is an idea. And yet, nevertheless, we find that when the idea of beauty arises, there's often a symbol, a form associated with it. Yeah. It wouldn't have any weight if it didn't have mass. To rely on physics a little bit there. It wouldn't have any emotional punch if it wasn't solid, if it wasn't anchored with something physical. And so what is nimitta? As we begin to explore it, we realize that it is a bridge of sorts. A nimitta is a bridge between knowledge and vision. And it is a place where knowledge and vision are sort of linked to give an idea weight or to give an object meaning. And why would the mind do this? Well, that's a very complicated thing. And it's not something we can say specifically. But thinking about it, if think about how you think for a moment. What is a thought? Yeah. If we were to look at our mind and see all the different thoughts arising and quickly, 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 we have so many thoughts in a second. And we were to take a snapshot and then we were to put that under a microscope and look at it and see each of these individual thoughts, what would we see? As it turns out, what we would see is nothing more than a string of symbols. Yeah. These symbols identify different ideas, and that our mind is something like a computer, because a single idea is not enough to have a conversation. Our train of thoughts is a process of linking these ideas, these symbols, one after the other. Yeah. So we take something that is a kind of a fundamental idea like beauty, and it's great, beauty. But how do you describe something that's not simple and fundamental, like a parent? Well, that's going to have the symbol for beauty in it. Yeah, if you like your parents. But it's going to have the symbol for compassion. It's going to have the symbol for discipline. It's going to have the symbol for generosity. It's going to have the symbol for cleaning up somebody's bottom when they make a mess. A parent is a very multifaceted thing, and to understand something like a parent, which we have here in our physical world, you need a lot of these basic building blocks of symbols all in a row to kind of make that definition. So these nimittas are sort of like the letters in a sentence. What happens when we want to cultivate something like the Eightfold Path? What kind of symbols are we going to need to describe that? What kind of letters do we need to kind of type out that sentence? This is me perfecting the Eightfold Path, becoming the ultimate meditator, period. Well, we're going to need a lot of different symbols, right? When the Buddha talks about nimittas, he's not talking about these fancy reflex images that show up in meditation. He's talking about symbols, he's talking about themes. Yeah. The whole thing about reflex images came later when people started to want to meditate in such a way that they just thought that that was the solution. Yeah. We're not gonna use it that way. Instead, we're going to engage our faculties to look at these symbols themselves and say, how can we take control of our nimittas, take control of our symbols? And why would we? The easiest why is, well, do you want equanimity? What does equanimity mean? I was talking with somebody, and for 90% of the human population, equanimity has no meaning at all. You ask somebody is like, are you equanimous right now? And they'll be like, what? What is that? What is that? Some kind of duck? I don't know. What? What is equanimous? What is this word? Yeah, but for a Buddhist meditator, it's like, oh yes, I would love to be equanimous. Yeah, even keel, balanced in all situations. And you're like, well, how would you do that? And you're like, well, and exactly, yeah. We can be told that equanimity is something good, something that we should have, something the Buddha had, yeah, and something we should work to have. But what is it? Yeah, at first, it's just something we want, and that's the only emotional impact it has. We hear it and we're like, yeah, I should get some of that equanimity. Along the way, though, we actually experience it. Here we're sitting in meditation and we see, something go by that, it's an animal runs by and you're like, usually I would have made a big deal out of that, or we're driving down the road and we almost get in a car accident and we're like, oh, wow, that was close. I used to get really anxious when something like that happened. And now I'm looking and it's like, I'm driving a car. Of course, there's going to be close calls. This is a dangerous activity. It's good. It's still dangerous, even though the accident was almost back there. It could be the next one could be just around the corner. And it's like, this is what equanimity really feels like at the moment where we've got good and bad kind of weighing yourself. And it's like, well, I'm not going to stop driving just because this is dangerous. I need to get from point A to point B. I kind of accept. And suddenly you're like, oh, that's equanimity. The good and the bad are weighing each other, and I'm making a decision based on it. That's what they're talking about. Yeah. And so this once we experience it, we're like, that's what they were talking about. That's equanimity. But then you go back in meditation and you try to find equanimity. You're like, I'm just so restless right now. I'm just so anxious. I'm so spun out by all the things that are happening in my life. I need to get some equanimity, but how do I do it? Well, when did it happen? Well, it happened when I was in the car and I almost got in that accident. And I thought, well, it's my own fault for driving. And so we go back in our memory to that moment and we see the car almost hit us and we're going past and we're like, it's my own fault for driving. It's my own fault for driving. It's my own fault. It's my own fault for driving. And then we get it. It starts to coalesce in our mind again, this theme of equanimity. And now if somebody else was sitting next to us and like, oh man, how do I cultivate equanimity? And we're like, well, you have to almost get in a car accident. No, that's not how it works. Your near miss has no emotional impact for them. For them to understand it, they have to connect it with things that make sense for them. So the idea of equanimity and the form of equanimity, we have to create this bridge. Now, in the commentaries, they're using the word nimitta as a sort of byproduct. They're saying, look, you already have these definitions. You've just got to calm your mind enough so that you can tap into them. And this is true. This is not untrue. But as practitioners, as people who are trying to develop this energy theme, we should really take the Buddha's approach, which is to say, I can make a nimitta if I want. Yeah? I don't have to wait for one to arise in all of its shining glory in my completely purified mind. Maybe I can sit down and develop this. Because it turns out a nimitta is just built up of our associations. And the Buddha saw nimittas not as things that are as this ba like atomic structure that we can't do anything about. He saw this, a meditator looks at these like jewelry. If he's a goldsmith, he looks at jewelry and says, I could make that. I could make that. Totally, I can make that. It would take a little while, but I could do it. And so if we don't find that we have a lot of energy, we find that our mind inclines to, oh, bother, why try? Then this is simple. We've just got other symbols and ideas that are arising. We've got the hindrances that are arising. And so we say, okay, well, I have to get a strong notion of what energy is. Once I do that, then at any point where I notice I'm inclining towards just kicking back and enjoying the fruits of my practice and not moving forward at all, I can tap into that definition and say, no, wait, remember that one time I was on that meditation retreat and I got into the line for lunch. And I was looking at the food and I was saying, this is just the four elements. Bah, I'm going to go back and meditate. And so I just took a little bit of salad and a little bit of quinoa and I stuffed it in my face. And then I went back to meditate and I was so much happier. Like, remember that? Remember that feeling of like, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. This is what they talked about. Food is just, it's just four elements and it's all about the path. And you sat and you were so happy. You're like, I'm doing it, I'm doing it, I'm doing it. And probably you got that meditator's high where you're like, I'm gonna get enlightened any second now. And you probably burned up. Nevertheless, in that moment, energy was there and it was real for you. So as we're sitting here and we're saying, what if I were to tap into this symbol of energy and develop it so that at a time when I'm feeling lazy and laid back, I just press that button and I go back to that moment when I was at that meditation retreat, or I go back to that time when I was reading the sutta and I got so inspired, I immediately wanted to go meditate. Or I do that time when I heard that Dhamma talk by that one teacher who was talking about jhana, and I immediately sold half of my stuff and tried to move into a monastery. Yeah. How do I go back to that moment? And what we'll do and what we can do today, if you think about it, you take one of these, is try to connect the knowledge and vision. Yeah. Try to connect the form and the function, the nama and the rupa. These things, they're separate. They're different. They're completely independent. An object, just any object like this pen, is just rupa. It has no meaning. Yeah. And the idea, a writing utensil, has no form. It's just an idea. You can write with anything. You can write with your fingernail if you scratch hard enough. But when you combine the two, you have something with a lot of weight. Yeah? And when we need to write something, we're trying to look for the bridge. Yeah? We're trying to find something that's actually supposed to be a writing utensil because that's the best kind. Something is actually designed for writing. Likewise, when we need energy, we shouldn't just settle for any kind of energy. Oh, okay, maybe I'll clean up my meditation room. That's energy, right? Yeah, that's energy. And we'll get out our duster and we'll clean our meditation room. That's one kind of energy, but is that really the one we were trying to cultivate? Oh, yes, energy. I will plan out my meditation retreat next week. Yeah. Well, that's one kind of energy. Is that the kind of energy we wanted for meditation? It sounds like it's a little off. So we want to be able to sit down and say, well, what is the energy that leads to samadhi? What is the energy that leads to equanimity? What is the energy that's part of this whole package? Yeah. And that's what we tap into when we gradually build mass. We build these events, these ideas, these memories into a coherent structure. Now, where is the nimitta? Well, the nimitta is not the vision, it's not the image or the tactile sensation or the heart feeling. That's not the nimitta. And the nimitta is not the idea, it's not energy, it's not equanimity. The nimitta is an invisible bridge between the two. And this is something that's very important for mastering the mind. And we can't master the mind until we see that you can't find the real nimitta. The way we describe nimitta is when this bridge arises, when we have an image or a sensation or a heart feeling, and it has weight, it has meaning, it has something behind it, an idea coalescing around it. That is what we call a nimitta. And this is what the Buddha is suggesting we develop, to sit down and say, how can I gather up all of this mass around the idea of equanimity so that when things are really rough and out of balance in my life, I can say, oh, equanimity like the Buddha had. And suddenly we imagine ourselves like sitting there like a Buddha being like, this is suffering. This is all suffering. And it's okay. And I'm okay with it, just like the Buddha. And we see that this is all of the Eightfold Path is like this. All of the Eightfold Path is trying to describe this process of developing in this way, of trying to, when we reflect on the Buddha, reflect on the Dhamma, reflect on the Sangha, we're reflecting on equanimity, we're reflecting on samadhi, we're reflecting on energy. They all work together. And when we do one, we can be cultivating the other if we know that that's what we're doing. So can you hear me? No, probably, yeah, okay. Well, I think the recording will be okay. I saw that it froze for a second, but you can catch it later if you missed those couple. I don't know how much was cut out there. So what will we do today? Well, what I would suggest, if you would like, and only if you would like, is as we begin the meditation, to sit down and look at the state of your mind and say, if you say, I feel peaceful, well, then maybe you have some basis for kind of looking at samadhi for a bit. When you say, I want to do something, I want to get something done, it's been a very, very busy week. I haven't felt like I've been practicing. I want to make some progress today. Well, then take a look at energy. Or if you're thinking like, wow, it's, I'm feeling calm. I'm seeing the world around me is in flux, but I don't want to participate. I just feel like observing and I want to watch. Well, then take equanimity and choose one of these themes, one of these signs, one of these symbols. And literally plop down a sign and say, okay, equanimity, or okay, energy. And then see if you can add some ideas. Be like, when else have I felt this? Or when else do I think this should arise? And see if you can imagine a scenario where you will have this quality arising in that moment. Try to come up with a couple different ideas. And what you might feel if you're able to, this is a lot like how we do metta meditation, loving kindness. You start by thinking of somebody giving you a gift. You start by thinking of somebody, giving you a compliment. You start by thinking of somebody you like or who's been beneficial to you. And gradually that gets you like thinking about giving a gift to other people. And gradually that gets you thinking of like, wow, everybody's so nice. And suddenly you're like, oh, yeah. What happens is you take a bunch of little ideas and you gradually connect the dots until you have a nimitta of loving kindness, a nimitta of the beauty of the human spirit. And suddenly it's something that has a life of its own, because a nimitta is not just the images and it's not just the feeling. It's not just the idea, oh, kindness, oh, generosity, oh, love, but it connects them. It brings them together. So every thought you're thinking, every person you think of, suddenly you're happy for them. You like them. You appreciate them. And every time you think of somebody you normally hate, you're like, ah, they're not so bad. because this nimitta has grown. And so likewise, you see if you can tap into this nimitta of the sign that you have chosen. Yeah. See if you can, and you won't be able to point to it, but see if you can know that it's there. Yeah. It's like, oh, wow. Yes. This is what equanimity is like. And if you think you've got it, then imagine a scenario. Yeah. I'm walking down the path and I look up and there's a squirrel in the tree and it throws a nut at me. If you've got the sign of equanimity, you'd be like, huh. And that would be it. You'd be like, this is samsara and he's having his bad day. I don't have to have one too. And that means it works. Yeah. If you can take a totally unrelated scenario and your sign works and holds your mind into this area, then that's all you need to do. And you've started to develop what all of the ancient meditators are trying to cultivate. Yeah. These symbols that can redirect the mind into any direction you want. So the final thing to say is this is not a basic meditation exercise, nor is it the most complicated. This is the essential way that we develop the heightened mind. Yeah. For these advanced meditators, if they thought of some, if they got the sign or the nimitta of fire, then they would gradually be in control of heat. And so for them, the psychic powers is just suddenly they mastered the idea of the fire element. Yeah. And they could do all sorts of things with it. And I've never seen this personally, but it's the same principle. Yeah. When you get the nimitta of equanimity, you can employ this idea with its full weight, its full mass, anytime you want. If you get the idea of water, cohesion, you can employ this idea whenever you want. If you get the idea of vision, of seeing, then you can employ vision wherever you want. And this is what they're describing as psychic powers. You know, you get the idea, the nimitta of seeing, of what vision is like, and you can put your vision wherever you want. And it's like you could even put it up into the celestial realms. And if you don't believe that, it's fine. But I would just like to throw out there, wouldn't it be nice? And that's all I'm going to say on that subject. Wouldn't it be nice? So you can, it's sort of like the wise man's gamble, right? If you cultivate it and it turns out it doesn't exist, then you still had fun cultivating it. If you didn't cultivate it and it turns out it exists, well, you lost both ways. But if you cultivate it and it turns out that such things exist, then you win both ways. Yeah. So it's really your best bet to try anyway. And that's the wise man's gamble. But at the very least, I think you could see that equanimity, energy, and the composure of mind are more universal qualities that you'd like to be able to just plant whenever you feel the need. Yeah, whenever it's appropriate, whenever it helps balance the mind. So we'll give it a try. And we'll come back together in the afternoon and we'll see how it went. And we'll get to explore this a bit more. So now we'll begin our sitting and walking.